Hello and welcome back to Slightly Foxed, and this month, a gripping tale of buried treasure. Now, as you know, we're still recording these podcasts remotely, so perched in front of their respective laptops, we have Slightly Foxed editor Gail Perkis, who is in Devon. Hi, Gail.
Hi.
And fellow Fox Anna Kirk in London.
Hello.
My name is Philippa Lamb. I'm in Cambridge, near to today's guest, but before I introduce him, any news, you two?
I've been deciding what's going to go into the summer issue, and I haven't been abroad now for over a year, like most people. So we're going off to the Towers of Trebizond with Rose McCauley.
Ah.
We're going to visit Anthony Burgess's Malayan trilogy. We're travelling to Trinidad with V.S. Naipaul. We're climbing up into the Karakorums to Hunza with a dictionary hunter. We're going to climb Mount Kenya. We're going sailing on the Norfolk Broads, and we are going to have a tour of Tunbridge Wells with Richard Cobb.
Something for everyone there, Gail.
Exactly.
Anna, how have you been?
Very well, thank you. Yes, we've had the spring issue dispatch, trying our very best just to get good reading to readers. Everybody's been so supportive. Lots of happy recipients of the latest publications.
Yeah, and lovely messages from everyone too. So, Anna, I seem to remember that when we recorded the last podcast, you mentioned that it was going to be half an hour a day at least of reading. How's that going?
It's been a bit up and down, but I think I have mostly stuck to it. It's the perfect thing to get away from screens before bed, and I think that is quite a healthy routine to get into that I've been very much trying to stick to. So, actually, pretty good.
No, I agree. Before bed is definitely the best time, isn't it? Now, as I said, today we have a story for you about lost treasure and how it came to be unearthed by a scholar with a passion for his subject. Literary treasure, of course. A unique archive of letters, poems and drawings documenting a decades-long triangular friendship between two literary giants, Seamus Heaney and Ted Hughes, and the artist Barry Cook. Now, Dr. Mark Wormald of Cambridge University is the man who brought this all to light. He's an expert on the fiction and poetry of the 19th and 20th centuries and a long-standing scholar of all things Ted Hughes in particular. He co-edited Ted Hughes from Cambridge to Collected in 2013 and Ted Hughes Nature and Culture in 2018. And I'm really delighted to say he's with us now. Hello, Mark.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Where are you?
I'm at home in a fenland village about 8 miles out of Cambridge. My study at the back of the house, which may be interrupted by the latest in a distinguished line of slightly foxed dogs, our border collie.
Well, as you know, all dogs are welcome here. I've got building noise, as I always seem to do now. Not us, but our neighbours. Now, it's 85 poems by Hughes and Heaney, isn't it? Some unpublished, a great stash of letters and drawings. I mean, this is the sort of discovery a scholar's dream about.
It is an extraordinary haul. It's actually more than that. It's 85 poems in various forms, manuscript and typescript by Seamus Heaney, about a dozen poems by Ted Hughes. But Barry Cook, who was an extraordinary figure, was also friend to many other poets. And there are many, many poems and letters. But the highlight, really, is clearly this close and hitherto, certainly in the UK and outside Ireland, completely unrecognised friendship between Ted and Seamus and Barry.
So tell us a little more about Barry Cook, because not everyone will know his name. He was a British-born Irish expressionist artist, wasn't he?
That's right. He was born in Knutsford in Cheshire in 1931, was educated in the UK until 1945, when his father took the family to live, first of all, in the States, and then in Bermuda, where they settled. He'd long loved fishing, and he wanted to be a marine biologist, and in fact went to Harvard to study marine biology. But about 3 weeks in, he realised this was not for him, and he started painting and studying art history. And he was also always a passionate reader of poetry. And after Harvard, he went to Ireland, really, in search of fishing. A man called Jack Sweeney, who was an Irish-American, ran the Woodbury Poetry Room at Harvard, kind of mentored Barry. And in 1957, when Ted Hughes and Sylvia Plath came to read at Harvard, he befriended them. He then recorded them. And he had kept in very close contact with Barry, who was by that point living in Ireland, in County Clare, immersing himself in the life of water and the countryside. And he sent Barry this recording of Ted and Sylvia's reading, because he said he thought Ted and Barry shared, as countrymen, they shared a fascination and an absorption with the life of animals. Barry, by that point, was developing himself as a great painter of water, of fish, and became recognised as one of Ireland's leading artists. And from that point on, Barry remained out with the metropolitan Dublin world, which most artists in Ireland gravitated to. By the time he died, his obituary in the Irish Times described him as an artist's artist, highly respected. But what that leaves out is the fact that he was emphatically a poet's artist too.
And I think one of his works, his portrait of Hughes is in the National Gallery here, isn't it?
It is, it is. Ted sat for that when weather, and it had to be pretty wild weather, blew them off their lakes in Ireland during their fishing trips together. Ted was slightly worried about that portrait because it had a kind of rat's nose, as Barry described it. All of his portraits are like that, extraordinarily vivid. And he was a great sensualist as a painter.
So this collection of fascinating items is now known as the Barry Cook Archive.
Yes.
And it was all thought to have been lost, wasn't it? So how did you come to be with Barry when he dug the box out and showed it to you?
Well, I had come across Barry Cook simply as Barry in Ted Hughes's fishing diaries, which have never been published, but really are at the heart of Ted's relationship with the natural world, chiefly as it's present in his collection River in 1983. And Barry kept coming up as someone he was fishing with Ted's son Nick too. So I wrote to Barry via his gallery in Dublin.
And he was presumably quite old at that point, wasn't he?
He was 81 at that point. And I wrote to him saying, I'm interested in Ted and Nick Hughes and fishing. And I didn't mention anything else. And he wrote back saying, come and stay. So I flew out in May 2012. Beautiful time of year. Glorious place too. Uh-huh. And I stayed with Barry. He was living in County Sligo above Loch Arrow. And he talked very movingly about how much he missed Ted and Nick Hughes too. He showed me fishing tackle that Nick had made, a pike spoon, which felt like relics of these wonderful fishing trips, wild trips that I'd already got to know through the diaries. And Barry said, just have a browse. And I browsed his bookshelves. And there was a shelf full of all of Ted's books, inscribed personally, which I was very excited about. But below that, there was a shelf of all of Seamus Heaney's books, all personally inscribed. And I said, what's this about? And he said, oh, Ted and I had fishing in common, but Seamus and I have mud and art in common. And he then said, outside Seamus's family, I'm the closest person to Seamus alive, which you will appreciate stunned me. The next year I contacted him because by that point, Olwyn, Ted's sister, had given me, amongst other things, an old battered stuffed trout, would you believe,
right.
Which Barry had left with Ted in Devon after one of the visits that he paid to him, because he'd seen a carved wooden salmon above the mantelpiece of a pub and wanted to swap it for this battered old trout. And clearly the publican was not having any of this. And anyway, Barry had never taken it back. So I was asked to take this trout back to see Barry. But by that point, it became clear that he had moved from Sligo. And he was living then in warden-controlled accommodation, semi-independently, in a village in County Kilkenny because he had developed dementia.
Right.
And lost his memory, his short-term memory. And Julia, his daughter, said, Dad may not remember that you'll be coming to visit him. But she rang him. He said, oh, yes, I want to see Mark. And I turned up the next morning and he welcomed me, made me a cup of tea. And I started reading to him a 200-line verse diary that Ted had written, never showed to anybody, about catching his first Irish salmon with Barry in February and March. The trip spanned the end of February, beginning of March 1980.
Oh, lovely.
And at the end of this, finally, after 5,000 casts of nothing, there was, as Ted put it, solid communication with the prize. He landed this salmon and the verse diary ended, it's the most beautiful fish I've ever seen, said Barry. And Julia, the night before, had said, as well as losing his short-term memory, Barry had lost the letters, she said. And I said, what letters? She said, oh, lots of letters from poets and poems. And in the move, we think he must have thrown them away in his dementia. And it's such a pity because they're amazing. And so Barry said, I did say that, Mark. And it was the most beautiful fish I've ever seen. And then he said, would you like to see the letters? And he turned, reached back into this curtained-off cubbyhole in this very Spartan maisonette that he was living in and pulled out this cardboard box, which had once held leeks, vegetables, and handed them to me. And there they were, stuffed with these amazing letters from Seamus Heaney, including a completely unknown fair copy manuscript poem called The Island, which I'd never seen before. Letters from Paul Muldoon and Robert Lowell and many, many other poets beside, and Ted about fishing.
So at this moment when Barry has shown you this box, you've looked in this box and you've thought, wow, some of this is new work. You then had to leave the box with him, presumably you couldn't take it away. Were you not frantic the thought that it might disappear? Yeah.
There was nowhere for him to chuck this. So long as I told Julia rapidly that they were still safe, they'd be fine.
It's spine tingling to hear about you opening this box and discovering what was inside it. Were things typewritten or handwritten?
They were mostly handwritten. There were some in pencil, there were photographs, but one lovely thing was a photocopy of a cartoon that Barry had made for Ted, of Ted in ermine leading a procession of his Irish trout fishing pals when he became poet laureate. And there was a caption to this, essentially recognising that Ted would have no time or inclination to fish with his Irish trout fishing pals again because he had the offer of fishing with the Queen Mum on the River Dee. And so it proved.
I think that cartoon's on the Cambridge University website.
It is, it
Mark?
Is.
Have I seen it there?
Yeah, you have.
I should say, for listeners, there's a great area devoted to this archive on the Cambridge website, and we'll give the link at the end so you can see some of these things for yourself. So, Mark, before we get into the detail of all this, can you give us a sense of who was involved in this friendship and at what stage they all met each other?
Sure. Ted and Barry first met at London Zoo in 1960. When Ted and Sylvia had just returned from America. They first fished together in September 1962, just as Ted and Sylvia broke, and it really was a breaking of the last week they spent together as a man and wife. And in October 1962, Seamus, without knowing either of them, read Lupercal and felt, as he said later, confirmed. This was a confirmation. Scroll forward to 1968. I think Barry met Seamus first in Nottingham in 1968, but it was when they met together in November 1971 in Kilkenny that their friendship really took off.
So obviously this triangular friendship lasted many decades, but how often did they actually get together?
It did indeed last decades for more or less 40, 50 years in each case. They got together with different frequencies at different stages. Barry and Ted met most frequently from 1977 to 1983, when Ted was working on River, but most importantly, when Ted and River's dedicatee, Nick, Ted's son, and Barry's daughter, Anya, were fishing together three or four times a year sometimes. During those visits, Ted would often stay in Dublin with Seamus, either en route to or on the way back from those fishing trips, which at that point Seamus did not join. Seamus and Barry met in Dublin, but really from 1971 to 3, 4, 5, 6, they would meet in Kilkenny and I think probably a little bit in Wicklow, but very intensely. And I think it's worth saying too that Jerpoint, Barry's second house on the River Nore, which they bought in 1972, that's where Station Island started, and it features in Station Island.
And the correspondence fills in the gaps of all, the,
Complete,
all these meetings.
Completely,
the
yes,
years.
It, yeah. It does. What does become clear is that time spent together, whether by the river or in the studio, was sustaining, refreshing, in a very real sense, nutritious for all of their work.
So obviously this triangular friendship was little known, but I mean, was it intentionally secret?
I don't think I would describe it as secret, but I would say it was private. In a recent book by Norman Foster about Seamus's work, he describes the fact that Seamus, as the great public international figure, famous Seamus,
yes,
needed to practice evasiveness and he needed to disappear. There is a letter in the archive describing Barry's role in all of this. The poet who has a gift to make to society needs at times to be able to withdraw from society. And Barry's island, both the house that he lived in and metaphorically the island of Barry's company and his immersion in the natural world, continued to nourish elements of Seamus' work, which he, drawing as he did on his own memories of a country childhood, found central to his imagination.
There's the content of the archive itself. The kind of equally important treasure is the light that all this throws on the three men and who they were, isn't it? Because we think of
completely
Hughes as a very tortured soul. There's the whole Sylvia Plath, you know, dreadful suicide. Seamus Heaney, obviously an entirely different sort of person. Can you talk a little about that for us? What we've learnt about them?
You began at the outset by referring to buried treasure, and I think we need something a bit more watery. So subsurface, I would prefer, because water was the connecting, the essential element and medium that these three men had in common. Everybody, I think, even a genius of a writer, most people need to do something as well as writing and sleeping and eating. Barry and Ted found in fishing what Ted described to Barry's daughter Anya as a way of breathing. It was his way of connecting with the natural world and living intently through the natural world. And fishermen tend to be fanatics. And you don't really need to be patient as a fisherman. You need to control your impatience. And Ted spoke about fishing being the form of activity where the essential primitive life force is at its most pure in modern civilization. Very striking claims made. So to have that in common, to find someone who felt the same thing, was affirmative and nurturing. Certainly that explains Ted and Barry's early relationship. Seamus became a poet and started writing and believing that he could write poems that would last in 1962. And now, as a student in Belfast, the poems he published were under the pseudonym Incertus, so uncertain.
Right.
But as it happens, he read Lupercal, Ted's second collection, published in 1960, within a couple of weeks of Barry and Ted spending time fishing together in County Clare for the first time. So there is a kind of curious conjunction of intellectual affinities. But to be honest, as Ted and Seamus became better known and internationally known, they both needed a form of escape. And I think Barry provided them with that. And for Ted, Ted's personal life was, of course, tragic. He suffered fairly considerably as a poet at the hands of a particular kind of American feminist. He did feel hounded fishing, not just with Barry, but the river was a kind of escape. Very movingly for me, when I visited Barry in 2012 in County Sligo, he took me up to these megalithic passage tombs called Carrow Keel. He said, go and climb into one of them. And when I came out, he said, Ted and Nick did that. And Ted spent an hour in there in 1992. And he wrote to Seamus that that hour found him, quotes, completely happy. And I think the friendship between the three men gave them that nurturing, sustaining, refreshing, secret source of affirmation and across distances. And I think Seamus and Ted found that in each other's company. They started writing, producing anthologies while Ted was en route to fish with Barry. Though they rarely spent much time, if ever, I think, spent much time together, this was a very definite triangulated friendship which nurtured all three of them.
I mean, just to remind people about the Hughes situation, obviously he was married to the American poet Sylvia Plath. She killed herself and he was widely condemned for his treatment of her. So the ins and outs of it are for perhaps another time. But would it be fair to say that it did overshadow him for the rest of his life?
Yes, it certainly did. And he found clearly, anyone who's read Birthday Letters knows this, the autobiographical collection that he published at the start of what turned out to be the last year of his life in 1998, finding a way of responding to the trauma of what happened to him and to Sylvia, of course, and then to Assia Wevel and their daughter Shura, who committed suicide in the same way that Sylvia had.
Yes.
He was driven to myth, I think, writing Crow, this great mythic, bleak, black comic work, which Barry illustrated, it turns out. It left him spent. And one thing that Barry did is that he offered Ted a sense of refuge, recourse. Barry told me that Ted arrived unannounced at Barry's house on the River Nore in County Kilkenny a few weeks after Assia's and Shura's death, and he just set to helping Barry pack some paintings for a commission. And they worked in silence together all day, and only at the end of the day did Ted announce what had happened. And Barry then wrote to Jack Sweeney saying, "We fished all day the next day." And that fishing as recuperation, restoration, staring into the life element of water and finding something submarine, subsurface in it, and bringing up from the depths something of comfort and something that corresponded, yes, to an element of themselves was key. Now, when Seamus got to know Barry, he got to know Barry as a painter before he met him. They then met for the first time when Seamus and Mari and the family came for dinner with Barry and his second wife, Sonia, in Kilkenny in 1971.
And this is the key dinner known as the First Supper, was it?
That's right, yeah.
Because it was the turning point for Seamus. He completely changed his life after it.
Yes, he had born and grew up in Derry in Northern Ireland, a son of a Catholic farmer. And he became involved in the civil rights movement, went on marches as he was writing the most extraordinary and widely praised poems. He and his young family spent almost a year in Berkeley in California, but came back in September 1971, living in Belfast, realised the horrors of living in a violent city. And I think the dilemmas of being expected to address this directly as the leading poet of his generation. Mm. And what Barry offered him and what the island offered him, this house in Kilkenny, and Barry's example, which is almost literally total immersion in an art of the elements and of the body.
And escape all those political pressures.
Was an escape from that. And, mm, and I mean, the archives proves this, that Barry was very keen for both Seamus and Ted actually to move to Thomastown in County Kilkenny. And neither of them did. I think Seamus, in the end, had a better offer, both closer to Dublin in the Wicklow Mountains. This is the cottage Glanmore, which inspired so many of his later poems. It was also a cottage with a functioning bathroom. A few more creature comforts.
Yeah, like an
always essential.
But it was closer to radio stations and airports.
So. Yes.
But as it happens, Seamus rooting himself in Wicklow in 1972 coincided with Ted buying with Carol Moortown Farm, a few miles from their home in North Taunton in Devon, and farming that farm with Carol's father. And Barry and Sonia had just moved upstream from the island to a more comfortable house, and they too were farming. And the three of them went to earth. And that kind of really striking conjunction in the period of their careers was crucial for all of them, because that was when Ted, recovering from the shock of Assia's death and Shura's death, began to realise that he needed to go back to a kind of diary poem, to the empirical observation of the world, which, as a poet of nature, had really made his name in The Hawk in the Rain and Lupercal in the 1950s and 60s. And then the fishing diaries really grew out of that subsequently. So it helps reframe the periods of not just of Ted's career, but of Seamus's career too.
It is just remarkable the way in which these papers, you know, throw so much understanding on what happened to these two men, or three men.
This is not just about text. It's about the friendships from which these texts and artworks emerge. One of my colleagues at Cambridge, John Kerrigan, wrote an excellent review of Seamus's collected poems, Open Ground, many years ago, in which he wondered how far you could go simply by studying more of a poet's work in isolation.
Yes.
And I think actually taking friendship seriously and taking something which people can confuse with a kind of extracurricular passion or just hobby seriously, even for Seamus, who was not a fisherman, he saw its significance.
Mm.
He said he only fished 12 times with Barry, but he said that was enough for a lifetime of poetry.
Goodness, yes.
And actually, once you're aware of that, it's not always subsurface in terms of his text. There are signs and connections in every one of his collections of poems and in many essays of Barry's absolutely pervasive, nurturing interest.
And of course, this really speaks to you, doesn't it, Mark? Because, I mean, I've been in your study at Pembroke in Cambridge and seen
yes.
Ted Hughes' fishing rods and flies. How did you come to have those?
Well, first of all, Ted Hughes studied English at Pembroke and he switched to archaeology and anthropology for his final year. And I discovered, as I started on this, that the reason why he switched was because of a dream he had at Pembroke towards the end of his second year,
right,
in which he was struggling and failing to write an essay on Samuel Johnson. And he got to 2 o'clock in the morning with barely a word on the page, gave up in disgust and flung himself on his bed and immediately fell into a deep sleep. And at that point, he dreamed that round the corner of his door and down the two steps into his room, towards the desk where he was still sitting in his dream, came a burning fox man, a fox but erect on its back legs. And it came towards this blank page where Ted was writing his essay, or failing to write his essay, put a bleeding paw, charred flesh, on the page and said, "Stop this. You are destroying us."
Wow.
Gosh.
That's a powerful image.
Incredibly powerful image. And Ted reflected on this, interpreted it as what was wrong with the way English was taught at Cambridge at the time, that the academic study of poems and of the life of the world threatened to crush that creaturely life. And so he switched to anthropology and archaeology. And in fact, he subsequently described the critical prose he wrote as burning the foxes. But at any rate, every account he gave of this, and he gave many such accounts, there was one element which snagged my attention, which was that the burning fox man came down two steps into the room. As it happened, the study that I had when I arrived in Cambridge in 1992 had two steps down into the room. And that didn't correspond with letters that he wrote to Keith Sagar, who was his closest critic, bibliographer. But it did correspond with the college's room register at the time, which I found in the basement of our library.
Right.
And it turns out that my study had been Ted Hughes's bedroom.
No.
Good Lord.
and then I discovered that a fishing hotel in Devon where I'd learned to fish as an 18-year-old was run by two very close friends of Ted's. And he had been taught to cast for salmon by the guy who taught me to cast for trout. So I began to feel there was something a bit uncannily direct.
You were destined.
Anyway, I reported back to Carol Hughes, who very kindly gave us this, to apply for funds, national funds from alumni, to acquire a collection of Ted Hughes's work. And the fishing rods came on permanent loan, I'm delighted to say, from the West Country Rivers Trust, which was an environmental body working to preserve water quality and wild fish in West Country Rivers, which Ted co-founded in the early 1990s. And I have caught my first pike with one of those rods. So I have fished in Ted's footsteps. So, yeah.
Amazing. Now, thinking about acquiring the actual Barry Cook archive, I mean, how did you actually acquire it, Mark? Because presumably there was enormous competition from American universities. And I mean, the market for Hughes, who was poet laureate by the time he died, you know, Heaney, Nobel laureate, I think the most important Irish poet since Yeats. These are heavy hitters. So presumably the work is really valuable. How did you manage it?
I'm not going to say how valuable, but yes, it is. I managed it essentially because two of Barry's daughters have visited my study. They've heard me rabbit on. And I think they felt my interest in Barry as a fisherman, as an artist and as a friend of poets, meant that they wanted to give Pembroke the chance to raise money before offering it to American universities. Mm. They are terrific custodians of extraordinary material. But practically, for a British or Irish scholar, it costs £1,000 a throw to fly across. Olwyn Hughes very, very kindly left a significant sum to Pembroke. But in addition to that, I then made a number of applications to national funding bodies on the basis that we would make these in a way that's consistent with copyright legislation and the wishes of the estates available to the public. So the idea is that we make this material not just available to visiting researchers in our library, but we stage temporary exhibitions and events to tell the aspects of this story.
I've got visions of this cardboard box.
with the leaks
I mean,
in
it's
it.
A very basic question, but being a publisher myself and being practical about these things, I mean, how did it get transferred from his daughters to Cambridge? I mean, did you go and pick it up yourself?
No, the family brought it to Cambridge. All I then had to do was when, remarkably, just as lockdown hit, I just went and collected it from Jones House in Cambridge and deposited it in the library for safekeeping.
And what will happen to it now?
Works on paper are pretty robust. I witness their survival in this cardboard box.
Yeah, we've talked about this on the podcast before with ancient Chinese manuscripts, haven't we, Gail?
We have.
They will be catalogued over the next months and the work is underway, but the paintings and the artworks have already been conserved. We're fine and it's secure. And then we will open at some point in the middle of this year, we hope, to visiting researchers, and there will be an electronic archive online through the Cambridge University's library system to enable them to make targeted raids.
Did you run into any sort of questions around the rights and wrongs of Seamus Heaney's work being outside Ireland, Mark? Because obviously this is a very topical debate in all areas at the moment.
I was acutely conscious of this. I do think, though, that it was a decision for the family. I think the family were aware that in terms of budgets and endowments and funds, it's one thing for Seamus to give, as he did extremely generously, I think in 2011, his archive to the National Library of Ireland. And so they have an extraordinary resource, much more extensive than this. But I think the fact that clearly this would be nurtured, cared for, made available, and there's a commitment to share this as regularly and as openly as possible with Irish institutions. There is great interest from the Seamus Heaney Home Place, from the Seamus Heaney Centre at Queen's University in Belfast, and from Trinity College Dublin, and from University College Cork already.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask Mark, I think you mentioned some other correspondence from other poets.
Yeah.
I think Ed Lowell and Tom Paulin, I think you mentioned.
Yes.
I mean, was Barry Cook introduced to them through his relationship with Seamus Heaney? I mean, what was in these letters?
No, thank you, because we actually haven't touched on that. In 1974, by which point Barry was very close friends with Seamus and Ted, and in fact working on an edition of Bog Poems, Barry and his second wife, Sonia Landwehr, Dutch potter, got together with a number of other artists in County Kilkenny to start the Kilkenny Arts Week. And Ted and Seamus advised Barry on the poetry strand of that Arts Week. And essentially what happened was that in the absence of ready budgets in Ireland to fund acquisitions or visits, Barry and Sonia opened their house to poet friends of Ted and Seamus and their own, who came and read in Kilkenny town at a pub, but stayed at Jerpoint. And Jerpoint became this extraordinary haven for Irish poets and for American poets. And so Robert Lowell, basically came and wouldn't leave. He spent, I think, a fortnight sitting in the orchard watching peacocks in the apple trees, Seamus getting the geese in at night, and they all loved Barry and Sonia's amazing food. And Cook's Cauldron, as it became known, was famous amongst these poets. And there was also a visual art strand. And so Barry also, though sort of a recluse, was also the most wonderfully supportive mentor to a whole generation of Irish artists. And so immediately after the announcement of this guest book, with which poets and artists came and wrote poems out and drew amazing pictures of their stays, one of the artists in this guest book sent all of Barry's letters to him. And Barry, I think it's important to say, was himself the most fantastic letter writer. And so he reflected in one of these letters to Paul that poets are more inclined to suicide because they have to redress, approach, express their obsessions through the medium of thought and words more directly, more nakedly than visual artists can, because they can paint a picture of a stone and they can express their obsession in the quality that they give to that stone. But a poet can't escape from that directness. And I'm sure somewhere that is informed by his own knowledge of Sylvia and Assia and other poets too.
Mm. Mark, this has just been so interesting to hear about. Thank you so much for coming on and telling us all about it.
It's an absolute pleasure. I hope I haven't gone on for too long.
Not at all. No, I could sit here listening for hours. That was absolutely riveting. Thank you so much for such enthusiasm and such knowledge.
Well, thank you.
I've learnt so much.
Mark, will you stay with us and give us a book recommendation in a little bit?
Yes, of course.
Before that, a brief word about Slightly Foxed. Elegant, eclectic and entertaining, Slightly Foxed is the literary quarterly for nonconformists. It introduces readers to all those wonderful books that languish on publishers' backlists but are often very hard to find in bookshops. Among its contributors are distinguished writers and novelists and people from other walks of life, all of whom share their passion for particular books and authors and write about them beautifully. Now, since it's entirely independent, Slightly Foxed is free to follow its own nose and celebrate the offbeat. So why not take out a subscription? £48 for an annual print subscription in the UK and Ireland, and £56 overseas. Your subscription also includes free access to all the back issues in the digital archive. Here's the web address, foxedquarterly.com, or if you'd rather talk to a human, give the office a ring on 020 7033 0258. Thank you. Now, Anna, talking manuscripts and letters and paintings, you've got another of your book lovers' day trips for us, haven't you? And it has all that and more, and it's in Rome.
Yes, particularly appropriate, relating to what we've just been talking about, but also taking us to sunnier climes.
Yes.
So, yes, I thought we'd go to Keats Shelley House on the Spanish Steps in Rome, 26 Piazza di Spagna, the final home of John Keats, who died there in 1821, aged 25. That was actually 200 years ago last month. And yes, he died there. His health was waning and he was going there for the warmer weather. His apartment there is retained as it was. It's his bedroom is preserved as a shrine. There's all sorts of other kind of artifacts. There's a whole archive of various materials relating to both him and the British Romantic poets in Italy is what the whole museum is dedicated to, displaying treasures and curiosities. So you have things like the last drawing of Keats by his friend Joseph Seven, first editions of Endymion and Lamia, locks of Keats and Shelley's hair, letters of Shelley, Byron, Leigh Hunt, Trelawney, Mary Shelley, the Brownings, extraordinary artefacts. And these particular artefacts were actually, they were kept in boxes when the museum had to be closed during the Second World War, and they were sent away, but they were left unlabeled. And it was actually this omission, not labelling them, which actually saved them from the German inspection. So it's extraordinary that they were able to be returned to the museum in 1944.
Yeah.
And it also has a library of over 8,000 volumes, and they're all pertaining to the British Romantic poets. And once we can, I would definitely suggest visiting. There's beautiful terraces, as well as you can browse the library. You can see Keats's death mask if you're so inclined, and it really takes you back and you kind of feel these ghosts in this place.
Oh, you describe it very vividly, Anna. You made it all pine to be there.
Well, yeah, it was actually years ago that I visited it, but it's still very much burned into my memory. I went to Rome on a solo holiday and it was just a glorious afternoon just wandering these rooms.
Ah, I can imagine. Right, now on to book recommendations. Anna, why don't you start us off?
So actually, interestingly, I'd just finished this book when I heard that we were going to be speaking to Mark today.
Uh-huh.
And it's called The Silent Woman by Janet Malcolm, which was originally published in 1992 and I think caused a little bit of a stir, but it's recently been reissued by Granta. It's a strange kind of hybrid, I suppose. It's a kind of literary detective story by a journalist, but is also sort of a biography of both Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes, but it's more about the nature of biography. It has aspects of memoir, journalism, philosophy, which makes it all sound quite heavy, but it's actually quite a slim volume that it's storytelling, essentially. And it's kind of the antithesis of those big doorstep tomes that you usually get with these biographies. It examines those previous biographies of Sylvia Plath in order to kind of create a book not about her life, but about her afterlife, the legacy, the myth that has been created around her and Ted Hughes, as we were discussing earlier.
Interesting.
And she speaks to all sorts of people, including Olwen Hughes, Ted's sister, and Stevenson, who wrote Bitter Fame, one of the biographies that she goes into, which I actually have on my bookshelf, so, and it cast it in very different light, which is, I guess, that's what she's looking at in this book. It's like how you look at biographies. They're always going to be a sort of fiction, but it's also very entertaining, and I think it really stayed with me and really just made me think about these people as people, you know, as Mark was saying earlier, this kind of humanising.
Yeah. Mark, what have you got for us?
Well, just to say, The Silent Woman is indeed a terrific book, and Janet Malcolm writes beautifully. If I had to choose one, I think I will actually go for a book that is now available as a Penguin paperback, but which was a profound influence on both Ted Hughes and Seamus Heaney, which is called A Celtic Miscellany by Kenneth Hurlston Jackson, published first in 1951. And they are translations from medieval Welsh and Irish poems and stories. And Ted and Sylvia spent their first months of married life in Cambridge reading from this and being inspired by it. When it first came out as a Penguin paperback, it was reading that Seamus Heaney used to inspire his work on what became Sweeney Astray, which is a wonderful story of a mad, profane, God-hating King of Derry who hears a cleric marking out ground for a new church on his land, is so outraged that he dashes from the bedroom wearing only a cloak and arrives stark naked, chucks the Bible into a loch, and when he next meets St. Ronan in a battlefield, Sweeney is again outrageous and is cursed by Ronan to fly naked round Ireland as a bird man, which he does for 300 years.
Harsh.
And becomes Ireland's first nature poet. Anyway, Seamus took that from there, as did Robert Graves before Ted, and I think it's a wonderful compendium and source book, which poets and writers I know are still drawing on.
Thank you. Gail?
Well, I'm going to recommend something quite different. It's a very slim novel called The Mission House by Caris Davies, and it was published last year by Granta. And it's set in a South Indian hill station. And the hill station is full of the legacy of the Raj. There are botanical gardens, there's an old race course, and there's a train that brings people up from the hot, dusty plains to the hills. A man called Hilary Bird, who's in his 50s, lost his job as a librarian, and he's actually really lost his purpose in life. He's tall, lanky, slightly stooped, has a paunch. He's adrift, really, and has become dependent on his sister, Wynne. and he decides to try and find a purpose in his life. He decides to travel to India, but he can't cope with the heat on the plains, and by good fortune he meets a padre on a train who says, "I have a mission house in a hill station, come and stay with us." So he does, and the mission house has a housekeeper called Priscilla, who had been abandoned as a baby, and she has one leg shorter than the other, and she has no thumbs, and the padre has taken her in, and he's desperate to find a husband for her. Anyhow, he suggests to help Hilary Bird that he teach Priscilla English, and then he goes on to teach her how to cook and also how to sew, and he gradually falls in love with her. She, however, has other plans, and I'm not going to give the plot away. While all this is happening, this is set during the rise of Narendra Modi's BJP party, a party of Hindu nationalism, and there are five young men in the hill station who are fired up by the BJP's propaganda. They're looking for a symbolic victim.
Sounds ominous, Gail.
The story ends tragically, but also very movingly, and Hilary Bird does indeed find a purpose for his life.
Thank you. That is it for this month. Many thanks, Mark. We've so enjoyed having you with us and hearing all about the Barry Cook Archive.
An absolute pleasure.
As I said, there is a great area dedicated to the archive on the Cambridge University website. There's illustrations, video, more explanation. We'll put the link in the show notes. We'll be back in April. In the meantime, you'll find all the books and writers we mentioned in the show notes. And if you find yourself with a spare minute, you might rate us on iTunes if you're enjoying the podcast. We very much hope you are. And thank you to everyone who's been in touch with reviews and very generous comments. It's always a real treat to read them. Thank you. A quick newsflash before we leave you. Now, you may know that Slightly Foxed has a Best First Biography Prize every year. This year, since recording this episode, the winner has just been announced, and it's Heather Clark for her wonderful book Red Comet, The Short Life and Blazing Art of Sylvia Plath. Now, of course, Sylvia Plath came up in our discussion with Mark Wormald in this episode, and we're now very much hoping that Heather might be able to find time in her schedule later this year to join us on the podcast and tell us about Sylvia's writing and her life. We'll keep you posted. So until next month, thanks for listening and for joining us on another literary trek off the beaten track.